Jonesboro, Arkansas.
Columbine High School, Littleton, Colorado. Well, obviously you know that these are all sites of school massacres. Paducah, Kentucky, a dozen kids at an early morning Bible study were killed by a kid who came to school with a gun. In Jonesboro, Arkansas, two kids sitting on top of a hill shot a teacher and a dozen of their classmates during recess. And of course, at Columbine High School, Klebold and Harris came to school with some guns and bombs and killed a teacher and 20, 25 of their classmates. And that last one especially, I don't know if you watch TV, but I'd be amazed if you didn't. It's almost as if we were there. The TV cameras were there and rolling while the guns are still shooting and the bombs are still going off. And if you're like me, you watch the kids fleeing for their lives from the building. And, you know, the fear was real. You could see it on people's faces. And it was a horribly fascinating thing to watch. And I think one of the most fascinating things of all were the interviews of the survivors. And one of the things that I noticed in the interviews, not just Columbine High School, but some of the others, is something that kept coming up over and over. And that was that some of the kids said that as they were being interviewed, that they thought they had been saved for a reason. And maybe it's because I saw the same interviews over and over. I kept hearing this again and again. I found myself begging the interviewer to ask the question that begged to be asked. Why were you saved? What, you know, they're saved for a reason. What was the reason? Well, I was disappointed in the interviewers because they never asked. And, you know, I guess looking back on it, I don't really blame the interviewers for that. You know, if I was standing talking to a kid who was struggling to find meaning in why their friends had been killed, but they had not, and some of them had guns pointed at them and they're asking, why was the trigger not pulled? By someone who seemed to be intent on killing everyone, why the trigger hadn't been pulled? They were struggling to find meaning in that. And to ask them, why are you here? Well, it's not a very big stretch to ask, why are any of us here? And I think that's a question that most of us would rather not deal with. But I think it's a question none of us can really avoid. Why are we here? What is the purpose of life? I want to take a moment to talk about why we can't avoid that question. I think the answer to that, why we can't avoid it, is because the answer to that question is an essential part of life for us. We have to have an answer to that question, why we're here. I think if you're familiar with computers, every computer has a basic program that operates the whole computer, whether it's DOS or Windows or Macintosh's operating program. Every other program depends on that program to operate. And if there's something wrong, the computer doesn't work. All of us have to have an answer to that question, or we can't even function. Recently, I went with the high school and college group backpacking out in Colorado a month ago. And there are several people there who are at the stage of life where you've got to answer some pretty big questions. And some are in relationships where they're wondering if that's the right person. You know, am I going to marry that person? I mean, that's a big question. Others are dealing with what to do regarding college or careers. And everybody that was asking those questions were struggling with the answers. And, you know, there's a lot at stake in those questions. You have to live with the answer to those questions the rest of your life. And you want to make the right choice, because if you make a mistake, well, it has such far-reaching consequences. And there were some there who dealing with those questions that is causing them such agony that they couldn't discuss them without tears. You know, it's difficult, hard to answer those questions. Ultimately, you have to ask, why am I here? What is the purpose of my life? It answers a lot of questions for you. Like, for instance, let's say that your answer to that question, why am I here, is to be rich. So you take the question, who should I marry? Well, if you want to be rich, obviously you marry somebody with money. And other considerations like love are really secondary, unimportant things, because after all, the important thing is to be rich. So you got to marry someone with money. And what do you do for a career? Well, you choose a career. You go to a college that's prestigious, but you choose a career that's going to pay you a pretty good income. And you're not going to be a policeman or a school teacher, because and after all, in the end, the important thing is to get rich. It's not going to matter what you're good at or what you enjoy doing. You're going to choose something that'll pay you an income. And if along the way you can steal or cheat to get ahead and you can get away with it, that's not going to matter, because the important thing in the end is to get rich. And if somebody gets in your way as you're climbing up the ladder and you got to knock them off, well, you know, that's too bad, because everything is subordinate to getting rich. So, you know, it's your personal philosophy of life. It's how you operate. You have to have an answer to that question in order to answer any other question in life. We have to deal with it. But you know, how many conversations have you had recently about what is the purpose of life? It's a subject we'd rather not deal with. And I think there's a couple of reasons why we'd rather not deal with it. And one is that it's so difficult. You know, this is really a question of the ages. People throughout time have been asking and searching for the answers to this question. Why are we here? What's the purpose of life? Smarter people than you and I have tackled it and have struggled with it. I don't know if you've heard of Stephen Hawking. He's a physicist in Britain, probably one of the smartest people alive today. He's made significant contributions both in science and philosophy, in spite of having a serious handicap. He's got Lou Gehrig's disease, and you know, he can't control his body very well. He hardly can talk. He's got a brilliant mind. Some years ago, he gave a talk at Cambridge University in England on the subject, is man determined or is he free? Now, the idea is, if he's determined, there, you know, if there's a destiny for us, I mean, there is a purpose. And his answer to the question, is man determined or free? This is it. This is what he said. Is man determined? Yes. But since we do not know what is determined, he may as well not be. What a non-answer, huh? I mean, was that a satisfying answer? Everyone was disappointed. And in my mind, he didn't do any better than those kids surviving the school massacres who came out and said, I was saved for a purpose, but I don't know what it is. And he said the same thing. There's a purpose, but I don't know what it is. I think that's what happens to a lot of people struggling with this question. What's the purpose of life? I think there's some purpose out there, but I'm not quite sure. I think the other reason that this is a really tough one for us, we'd rather not deal with it, is because I think in our heart of hearts, we know we're not going to like the answer. Or that the answer we give to that question, we're going to ultimately find out that we were wrong. I mean, imagine getting toward the end of your life and you find out that you have given your life to the wrong thing. You've wasted your life. I don't want to have that happen. And, you know, I think it's part of the reason why all of us struggle with this. We don't want to deal with it. Is we don't want to be wrong. Now, it's not like this question is without answers. In fact, there's a lot of answers out there, some pretty common ones. Life magazine a few years ago put out an article on mankind's search for meaning. And they interviewed philosophers, they interviewed drug addicts, they interviewed everybody in between, asking them, what is the meaning of life? And I'm going to read to you one of the answers, which I think summarizes the common philosophy today. And this is by Jose Martinez, who is a taxi driver. This is what he had to say. We're here to die. Just live and die. I live driving a cab. I do some fishing. I take my girl out, pay taxes, do a little reading, then get ready to drop dead. You've got to be strong about it. Life is a big fake. Now, clearly, he didn't like the answer he'd come up with, but he believed it was true. And truth can be compelling. You have to accept it, whether you like it or not. He goes on. Nobody gives a damn. You're rich or you're poor. You're here or you're gone. You're like the wind. After you're gone, other people will come. It's too late to make it any better. Everybody's fed up. Can't believe in nothing no more. People have no pride. People have no fear. People aren't scared. People only care about one thing, and that's money. We're going to destroy ourselves. Nothing we can do about it. The only cure for the world's illness is nuclear war. Wipe everything out. Start over. We've become like a cornered animal fighting for survival. Life is nothing. Basically saying there is no meaning to life. Now, sadly, I think this is a very common philosophy in the world today. I don't know if you listen to the oldies radio stations, but there's a rock and roll ballad named Dust in the Wind by Group Kansas. I don't know if you've heard it, but one of the lyrics goes that we're just like dust in the wind, and we're here and then we're gone, and it doesn't matter. And you can see it on a bumper sticker that it used to be popular. I haven't seen it for a while. It goes like this. Life is a bitch and then you die. Have you seen that one? I think this philosophy accounts for a lot of the meaningless evil that goes on in the world. Like these school shootings. I mean, if nothing matters, if life has no meaning, then nothing matters, good or bad, and any evil can be justified. And I think Jose Martinez is correct in foreseeing the ultimate result of this is destruction. Well, there are better sounding philosophies out there, and one of the most common is materialism. You know, the accumulation of wealth, prestige, power, things. I was given a deal here by a guy at work. He got this off the internet. I'll read it to you. To all hardworking Americans, the answer to the eternal question, is it better to be a jock or a nerd? Let's start with the jocks. Now, Michael Jordan makes over $300,000 a game. That's $10,000 a minute at an average of 30 minutes a game. With 40 million in endorsements, he makes $178,100 a day, whether he works or not. If he sleeps 7 hours a night, he makes $52,000 while he sleeps. If he goes to see a movie, it'll cost him $7, but he'll make $18,550 while he's there. He makes $7,415 an hour more than minimum wage. He'll make $3,700 and $10 while watching a half-hour episode of Friends. If he wanted to save up for a new Acura NSX, which costs $90,000, it would take him a whole 12 hours. If someone were to hand him his salary and endorsement money, they'd have to do it at the rate of $2 a second. He'll probably pay around $200 for a nice round of golf. He's well known for liking golf. But he'll be reimbursed $33,390 for that round. If you were given a penny for every $10 he made, you'd be living comfortably at $65,000 a year. He'll make about $20 while watching the 100-meter dash at the Olympics, about $15,600 during the marathon. When a regular person is spending about $20 for a meal in his trendy Chicago restaurant, he'll pull in about $5,600. This year, he'll make more than twice as much as all U.S. past presidents for all of their terms combined. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? However, if Michael Jordan saves 100% of his income for the next 250 years, he'll still have less than Bill Gates has today. So the nerds win. That kind of sounds pretty good. I mean, Bill Gates, I'd be happy being Michael Jordan, wouldn't you? Sounds pretty good. Or does it? Do you remember who Lee Iacocca was? He was the chairman of Chrysler Corporation, became chairman when Chrysler Corporation was about to go on the rocks. They were about to go bankrupt and dissolve. He became chairman, and he accomplished what many people thought was impossible. He took them from about to be dissolved to back to one of the top three car makers in the world. And as a result, he earned fame and fortune. And following his retirement from the chairmanship of the board of Chrysler, he wrote a book called Straight Talk. And this is what he had to say about all of that in his book. Here I am, in the twilight years of my life, still wondering what it's all about. I can tell you this, fame and fortune is for the birds. You all probably know who Boris Becker is. He was one time the best men's tennis player in the world. And following his second consecutive victory at Wimbledon, he shocked the world in the press conference following his victory by talking about his struggles with suicide. That all that fame and success, he couldn't find a reason to live. Another author named Jack Higgins, a book he wrote that you might recognize is called The Eagle Has Landed, said that the one thing he knows now at this high point of his career that he wished he'd known as a small boy is this: when you get to the top, there's nothing there. And for Bill Gates, for his millions, somebody that achieved more success than Bill Gates has, probably ever will, is Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great was probably the most brilliant military leader the world has ever known. He had conquered the world by the time he was 30. And he grieved that there was no more world for him to conquer. And he was dead by 35, having drunk himself to death. So maybe fame and fortune just aren't what they're cracked up to be. In fact, the Bible, God's comment on this is this: those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a trap, into many senseless and hurtful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all evils. You know, I think if we could take a close look at the lives of Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and Michael Jordan, we would find that they're probably, I mean, it looks good on the surface, but the reality is probably far different for all of those people. Another common answer to the question of why we're here is the pursuit of pleasure. And I think this is a real common philosophy in our world today, too. In fact, if you watch football, you'll hear this one on the beer commercials. And you've heard this: you only go around once, so grab all the gusto you can. Well, speaking of bumper stickers, I haven't seen this one for a while either, but used to be one out there that said, "If it feels good, do it." Do you remember that one? I think that this philosophy probably accounts for a lot of the problems in our society and the world in general, in terms of drug abuse and alcohol abuse, pornography, those kinds of things. People seeking after pleasure. The only trouble is that it seems that it's something no one can hold on to, that after you've obtained it, it goes away and you have to seek a little farther, do a little more, and ultimately you struggle with boredom. This is what a man named Ernest Vanderhaag says about this. He says, though the bored person hungers for things to happen to him, the disheartening fact is when they do, he empties them of the very meaning he unconsciously yearns for by using them as distractions. No distraction can cure boredom, just as the company so unceasingly pursued cannot stave off loneliness. The bored person is lonely for himself, not as he thinks, for others. He misses the individuality, the capacity for experience from which he has become exempt. No distraction can restore it. Hence he goes unrelieved and insatiable. There's no cure but an insatiable hunger. This is God's view on this also, on this philosophy. Many of whom I have often told you and now tell you even with tears lived as enemies of the cross of Christ. Their end is destruction. Their God is the belly. In other words, they've made God the thing that's most important to them. Their God is their pleasure. They glory in their shame with minds set on earthly things. Their end is destruction. Well, perhaps you're coming to the conclusion, if you haven't actually done so long ago, that it's the people on their own can't find out what the purpose of life really is, and may not even be able to find out if, in fact, there is a purpose. I'm going to read you. This is a song from the 60s, and you may recognize the words if you listen to the oldie stations. This is how the song went. From the canyons of the mind, we wander on and struggle blind. Wade through the often tangled maze of starless nights and sunless days, hoping for some kind of clue, a road to lead us to the truth. But who will answer? Is our hope in walnut shells worn round the neck with temple bells, or deep within some cloistered walls where hooded figures pray in shawls? Or high upon dusty shelves, or in the stars, or in ourselves, who will answer? If the soul is darkened by a fear it cannot name, if the mind is baffled when the rules don't fit the game, who will answer? Who will answer? Who will answer? Who has the answer? And there are many answers out there, but maybe they're not any good. Who has the answer? But you have a piece of equipment that's not functioning, you get out the owner's manual and see what the manufacturer has to say. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to get out the owner's manual and see what our manufacturer has to say. I'm going to open to the book of Ephesians. Before I tell you where we're going to go, I'm going to do something a little different, and I'm going to read you phrases, and we'll go back later and fill them in. First, we're going to look at the question of whether, in fact, there is a purpose to life. So listen carefully and look for clues as to whether there is, in fact, a purpose. Even as God chose us in Him before the foundation of the world, He destined us in love, according to the purpose of His will. For he has made known to us in all wisdom and insight the mystery of his will, according to his purpose, which is set forth in Christ as a plan for the fullness of time. In him, according to the purpose of him who accomplishes all things according to the counsel of his will, we who first hoped in Christ have been destined and appointed. And these are from the first chapter of Ephesians. And I've emphasized the words I thought that were key there. We've been chosen. Now, if you choose something, you have an idea in mind, a purpose. And if you've destined something, there is a goal, an ultimate goal. And, of course, it talks in there, it actually says the purpose of his will. And when you have a will, you have a direction, an end point in mind. God says, emphatically, there is a purpose for us. So let's go back and look at what the purpose is that God has for us. Why are we here? What is our purpose in life? Let's look at verse 4 of the first chapter. Even as he chose us in him before the foundation of the world, so that, here it is, a purpose God has for us, that we should be holy and blameless before him. Our purpose in life is to be holy and blameless before God. Now, this is not actually something we have anything, we've done anything about. It's something that's done for us. In fact, Christ's death on the cross has accomplished this because before God, we are neither blameless nor holy. But through Christ and his death on the cross, our debts have been wiped out. And we have been made blameless and holy. It goes on in verse 5, he destines us in love to be his sons through Jesus Christ. Our destiny is a new identity. So why are we here? We are here to be God's children. And again, this is not anything that we have a say in. It's something done for us. In verse 7, it says how this happens. In him we have redemption through the blood of Christ. Now, when I was a kid, you bought pop in bottles. It didn't come in cans. It didn't come in little plastic bottles. It came in glass bottles. And when you bought the pop, you bought the bottle. And you could take the bottles back to the store and they would redeem them. They would buy them back from you. And that's what's happened to us. When we sin, we got a new owner and God has bought us back to be his own. Now, when I sold bottles to the store, I got 5 or 10 cents a bottle. I don't remember anymore what it was. The price paid for us by God wasn't anything cheap like that. Blood was shed for us. A life was given up for us. That was the price to buy us back, is a life. Goes on to say, he has made known to us in all wisdom and insight the mystery of his will. Now, Stephen Hawking, he knows that there's a purpose in life. He doesn't know what it is. The kids coming out of the school massacres felt certain that they were there for a reason. But God goes a step farther. He has a purpose for us, and he tells us what it is. And his purpose for us, in verse 10, a plan for the fullness of time, is to unite all things in Christ, things in heaven and things on earth. And I think the things on earth that he's talking about are us things. We people, we're going to be reunited with God in heaven. And again, this is nothing that we have a say in. It's done for us. So we have all of these purposes which we don't do anything to accomplish. Now, isn't there something for us to do? Well, he finally gets to that in verses 11 and 12. In him, according to the purpose of him who accomplishes all things according to the counsel of his will, we who first hoped in Christ have been destined and appointed to live for the praise of His glory. Now this, nobody else has anything to do in this but us. This is our destiny, our appointment, our mission in life, to live for God's glory. Right? What's that mean, to live for God's glory? I think it's really broad in scope. Scott last week, he was asking, why are we here at church? And he mentioned that Bill Gates thinks it's a waste of time. I think Bill Gates, if his goal is making money, then going to church has nothing to do with making money, and it is a waste of time. But if your goal is the glory of God, what we do here is fulfilling our destiny. It fulfills our purpose in life. We're here for the praise of God's glory. I think it has to do with every part of life. It answers the question, those big questions. Who do I marry? It's big in that if your goal in life is to be the praise of God's glory, well, it says a lot about who you'll marry. And in a job, I kind of think a Christian can be rich, famous, but ultimately those things are subordinate to the higher goal of God's glory. Now, somebody I think who's really done this well is Ron Brown, a football coach. But Ron Brown uses his position as a football coach as a platform for a greater goal. His goal in life is God's glory, and you can't hardly listen to Ron Brown. They hand him a microphone. He's not talking much about football. He might start there, but he ends up talking about the God of glory. So I think it helps you decide and what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. I think it's going to rule your life. Have many of you seen the movie Saving Private Ryan? No, a few. I would think just about everybody's seen it. It's a pretty good movie. I didn't see it on the big screen. I saw it on TV, rented the tape. I'd heard a lot about the movie, but nobody told me that it started and ended in a cemetery. And as the movie starts, there's this old man at a cemetery, and you're wondering, who in the world is that? Well, at the end of the movie, you find out that the old man at the cemetery is Private Ryan. And you find out why he's there at the cemetery. He's there to give an account of his life to a gravestone, to a dead man. And you find out through the middle of the movie why he's there to give an account. He's there because a dozen men gave up their lives so that he might live. The last one, Captain Miller, as he's dying, demands that Private Ryan earn the life that was given to him. And he's there to give an account many years later of what he's done. And this is what he said. I wrote it down. His accounting to Captain Miller as he stands before his grave. This is what he says. Every day, I think about what you said to me on the bridge that day. I've tried to live my life the best I could. I hope that was enough. I hope that at least in your eyes, I've earned what all of you have done for me. And he desperately wanted to hear the dead captain say that he'd done well. And I think today, all of us are in Private Ryan's boots. Blood was shed for all of us, just as it was for him. A dozen men gave up their lives for him. For us, Jesus gave up his life. We've also been commanded, just as he was. He was commanded to earn the life that he was given. We also have received a command. Don's been in Ephesians for a number of weeks. And one of the sermons that impressed me most was a sermon on chapter 4, verse 1. I therefore, a prisoner of the Lord, beg you to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called. What's the calling it's referring to? I think it's referring back to chapter 1. The calling that God has given us to live a life worthy of His glory. Paul is demanding us to live worthy of the glory of God. And just like Private Ryan, because of the price paid for his life, he had to go to that cemetery and give an account. And so will we. We'll have to give an account to our God for the life that we live. So let us decide today to be done with the pursuit of meaningless things, lesser things, like the pursuit of money or fame or fortune or pleasure. And let us strive to fulfill our destiny, our purpose that God has appointed us to live for. Let us live lives worthy of the blood that was shed for us, so that in the day that comes, that is coming, where we have to stand before God and give an account of ourselves, that we may hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the glory of your master."